ladies liked Morgan Anderson.
Did they?
Yeah.
They punked him one day too. They had a videoed him, and they had this guy come in and say, "Hey, you're the most eligible bachelor in the United States. You've been by what Vogue magazine, but some big magazine," they said, you know. We went on and on. The girls just think you're beautiful. Well, yeah, you know. And I mean, it was. Then they showed it to the team, and it was hilarious. It was hilarious.
That's a good one. Yeah, that's a good one.
I'm Wade Phillips.
And I'm Wes Phillips. We're past and present coaches here to bring you an insider's perspective on the teams, the people, and the personalities that we've encountered over time.
And we're back, continuing on with our stories about Hall of Fame players that you or potentially I have coached in our careers. We hit last time on New Orleans, Houston, and then moving on to your time in Philadelphia. Obviously some great, great defenses there in those 3 years, some great, great football players, but maybe no one ever better than the next guy we're talking about, the Minister of Defense, Reggie White.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Reggie was special, we know, but he set a record I don't think anybody will ever break. He was a big guy, you know, he's 6'5", 300. He felt like, or he looked like, agility-wise, a linebacker. He could do all that kind of movement at that size, and so it was phenomenal the way he could move. And he was a ordained minister. They call him the Minister of Defense, but he's a very religious guy, a great guy, a lot of fun to be around, especially when when you needed to sack the quarterback.
Yeah, religious yet very violent on the field. It doesn't seem like it goes together, but, you know, he's known the people that know about the hump move, right? You know, you go one way, you get him to step that way, get their momentum and lean, and then you take your forearm and throw him, or try to throw him. Most people aren't able to throw offensive linemen just completely out of their way, but Reggie was certainly able to do that. Have you ever had a player as physically dominant as Reggie White was?
Well, not in that way. I mean, that hump move, you call it, or is normally called, was special to him. Now, you know, when I first got him, he wanted to run over everybody, and I did hopefully helped him there in a little bit, in that to rush the passer, you need to rush half a man. If you run right in the middle of them, the offensive linemen don't have to move their feet very much, so you don't gain a lot of advantage unless you're Reggie and you can still overpower them. But most people can't do that, and it's easier if you just take one side. And so he could generate so much speed and so much power collapsing the one side of the guy that they had to really, really, really push hard to stop him from doing that. To stop that momentum, they really had to just go out at him as hard as they could, and that's when he'd use that hump move, which really is not with your arm. You can't hit somebody and knock them down with your arm, no, even Reggie White. But it's really with your shoulder, the top of your shoulder, that you hit them with, and you got some power with that. But the most of it was because he was collapsing the outside, that they had to fight so much to get there and had to move their feet some, that he just basically threw them out of the way. And no, I haven't seen a player that could do that since then, and I don't know that we will.
Well, you make a good point, because I'm sure there were plenty of times where he didn't have to get to the hump move because he just won with his athleticism and speed on that outside edge or inside edge of the defender. But he seemed unique to me looking back, because you see more players, I think, doing it now, but he was kind of a dominant force no matter where you put him across the line. I mean, were you guys, when you're game planning, I mean, were you just putting him over the worst offensive lineman?
No, actually, it was a little bit different with him in that when we got there, he was playing defensive tackle in the 4-3, and they were doubling him all the time. And I really think it helped moving him out to defensive end. You know, he still had the speed, certainly, but he had great size. And that way you couldn't double him with the center all the time. And that's what he was getting the year before we got there. You know, Reggie went to the the Memphis Showboats for two seasons. When he got out of college, he signed with Memphis, the other league, and played a couple of seasons there, and then everybody knew how great he was. I mean, first of all, they knew how great he was coming out, but then, you know, when he played for Memphis, he did the same thing, and they don't count those sacks that he got with Memphis as part of the NFL, and he's the second leading sacker in the history of the NFL. And you know, one thing that I didn't realize until I read back on him, he set the record for PBUs of defensive linemen, which was 13, which was broken by J.J. Watt.
J.J. Watt, yeah.
So, I mean, and the other record he has that I don't think anybody will, you know, he held the NFL record for sacks, and Strahan broke the record, but the record was 21 sacks.
Sacks in a season, yes.
In a season, yeah. 21. He had 21 sacks in a season, but that was in 1987. In 1987, there was a strike, and so we didn't play four games. So he had 21 sacks in 12 games, which I don't think anybody can ever come close to. I mean, they asked me who the greatest player was. Well, that was the greatest sack season anybody's ever had.
No question. That right there needs to be brought up every time they talk about someone having a great season as far as sacks are concerned. I mean, 21 sacks in 12 games is the greatest season by a pass rusher ever. I don't know that there's anyone that could dispute that. Just such dominance.
Yeah, and then Philadelphia didn't. Of course, they had a supplemental draft then, and they took him as a fourth pick in the supplemental draft, which I don't know who the other three guys were, and maybe you can look it up, but I'd have a hard time saying that any of them were better than Reggie White.
Well, Reggie, of course, like you said, retired as the all-time leading sacker in the history of the NFL, and then has his number retired, actually, with two different teams, with Philadelphia and then Green Bay. How do you feel about retiring numbers?
I don't like anything about retiring. No, it's good in a lot of ways, certainly. I mean, to be remembered and that you remember that person and their great accomplishment, which is usually a great, great accomplishment in that time. Now, sometimes over time, people don't remember the guys, and so they say, why was that guy? I have a retired number, but at the time, they were that kind of player, and so it's good that it's remembered that way. I guess if you're a great team, you run out of numbers, it'd be tough. But we could do Prince's deal, I guess, and do whatever that he did, question mark, or I don't know, whatever. Symbols.
Yeah, we have
symbols,
to start going to symbols. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a pet peeve of mine. I've always felt like there's just not a lot of foresight there. Like, we're going to retire these numbers. You're already limited in the amount of numbers you get. Now they only have certain numbers that they can wear based on position, all those types of things. And then you start retiring numbers. You know, I'm a big fan of the Hall of Fame, Hall of Honor, Ring of Honor type thing they do at the individual stadiums. And then you've seen also people's jerseys get unretired. We talked previous episode about Steve Largent, and then when Jerry Rice plays there, they have a conversation. They unretire the jersey. So what does it really mean, you know? So you mentioned, you know, Reggie being taken in the supplemental draft in 1984, not a Hall of Fame story per se, but I do remember something about Buddy Ryan and you guys needing a fullback, and there was a story there where he wanted to take a fullback, I think, in the first round. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. When we first went there, you know, Buddy hadn't been a head coach before, and there's nothing against it or for it or against it, but I'm not sure how much he had to do with the draft, but obviously he was running the draft because that's the way Buddy was. And our offensive coaches had said, he went to the offensive coaches for the draft, said, what do y'all need? And they said, well, we need a fullback because they were going to have a two-back offense like they had in Chicago. Philadelphia didn't have the fullback that they wanted. And so they needed a fullback as one of their needs. You know, you have more than one need, certainly. So we get to the draft, and, you know, we talked about all the players and on defense. I was the defensive coordinator. And then we get to the draft, and then Buddy says, okay, you know, we got the 10th pick. We're going to take this fullback from Texas A&M. I said, Buddy, with the 10th pick in the draft, because I read about things, you know, who the top players are and, you know, top 10, 20, just like they do now. I mean, same thing. And this guy's not even mentioned in the maybe the top 100, but our coach that studied him, you know, has just been in college, came out of college, and he thought the number one fullback, which was this guy from A&M. I knew he wasn't thought of by any team that anybody was going to take him, plus that early.
Well, yeah, the best fullback. I mean, he may have been the best fullback, but still, we're talking 10th pick of the draft.
Yeah. And so we get to the draft, and Buddy's going to take him. I said, Buddy, you can't take that guy. He said, well, yeah, he's the fullback. He's the best fullback. We need a fullback. I said, but he's not a top 10 player. You can't take a guy just because, you know, you can't make him the top 10 player just because you took him. I said, anyway, he's not going to be taken in the first round. And he looked at me and he said, oh, by God, he better not be, or it's your job. I said, what? Because I finally talked him out of taking him. And we took a guy named Keith Byers, listed him as a fullback. He's really a running back. But we were going to take a fullback. He listed him as a fullback. And he did play, you know, he played several years and was a pretty good player. And Keith, we took in the first round. And then the second round, we took this guy named Anthony Toney at fullback. And he played some fullback for us, but he was an average at best player. Nothing against him as a person, great person. But we took him in the second round. And so we finally got to take some defensive players. And one of them we took was in the eighth round. We
Seth
took,
Joyner?
Yeah, Seth Joyner. Yeah. We took Seth in the eighth round.
UTEP.
Yeah, from UTEP. And then the ninth round, we took Clyde Simmons, who was another really good player for us. So we got two really great players at the end of the, towards the end of the draft. And another funny thing that happened, we get in the 12th round. Now, you had 12 rounds. You know, there aren't many players left. And I kind of see why Buddy did this. But he said, okay, we're taking this guy right here, you know. And this guy wasn't even on our board. I mean, he's on the leftover board, you know. Might try as a free agent. And he said, we're taking this guy right here. We had two picks in the 12th round. It was the first pick in the 12th round. We said, what? That guy can't play it. Buddy, we don't even have him. He said, I don't care. His name's Singletary. And I had Singletary with the Bears, and we're going to take him. And so we took Reggie Singletary, who wasn't the same as Mike Singletary and didn't play linebacker. He played defensive line. And he wasn't rated as a draft choice. He actually kept him on the team and tried to move him to offensive line. But so we got Singletary. He wanted Singletary, so we got him.
Wow. You know, you mentioned that ninth round taking Clyde Simmons, who was a great player in his own right. I mean, do you think he belongs in the Hall of Fame? He's 21st all time. With 121 and a half sacks throughout his career. I mean, most of these guys that are on this 100 sack club are getting Hall of Fame jackets. Now, you know, I don't know if he was two-time first team All-Pro and two-time Pro Bowler. So, I mean, he didn't make eight Pro Bowls.
Right,
but
right. Yeah, I think obviously he's close. I mean, it depends on who's picking. He was really a really good player. He was known for hurting the quarterback. He put a lot of quarterbacks out. When he wrapped them up, somehow when they fell on his shoulder a lot, and he had a lot of sacks, like you said. So he was a really great player. He was a stand-up defensive end at East Carolina. I'm not sure who – it wasn't me that picked him, you know. I mean, I was part of who we picked on defense, but but he was a stand-up defensive end. And I think part of it, too, playing with Reggie White kind of takes away from – you know, what a great player he was.
Sure. It's like Scottie Pippen or something.
Yeah, yeah. And then Jerome Brown came in there, too.
Well, that was my next question. Yeah. I mean, would Jerome Brown have been in the Hall? Was he that kind of player? I mean,
he sure seemed like it. I mean, I wouldn't – he wasn't Aaron Donald or J.J. Watt that early. He was a really good player, but he wasn't – like the best player in the league. Of course, Reggie White was there, but he wasn't the best defensive lineman in the league, but he was very, very good and had a bright future.
29 and a half sacks in 76 games, and his number also was retired. by the Eagles.
So we had three great players and Mike Golick.
Mike Golick.
That was the front four. Sorry, Mike. I'm kidding. but Mike was the other guy.
Yeah. Well, anyone, just about anyone's the other guy when you're talking that those three.
Yeah, that's right.
Right there. That's great. You know, as you went on your first stint to the Broncos, you guys picked a safety in 1989 at the 20th pick of the draft, a guy named Steve Atwater. Number one, just in general, you know, they talk about positions of when you take guys, and I mean, was there any reluctance taking a safety? You know, sometimes they say you don't take a running back that high, or you don't take a safety that high.
Yeah, I think a safety late in the first round is a good pick, you know, later in the first round. You know, if you have a need, and if you can anytime you can identify a Hall of Fame player, you probably should take him whenever you can, you know.
Sure.
Now, we didn't know he was going to be in the Hall of Fame at the time. And there was wasn't controversy, but there was another guy that we were looking at in that draft that played safety, and his name was Lewis Oliver. He played at Florida, and he was Steve's size, but he ran a 4.5. I mean, he was faster than Steve. Really, Dan Reeves was the guy. I mean, Dan said, all right, which one are you going to pick? To me, and I ended up saying Atwater. But the way he phrased it was, which one are you going to pick that's going to be a solid person, going to be, you know, the right kind of guy for our team? We knew all these things about Atwater. We didn't know the other guy that well. The other guy was a good guy, too, I'm sure. But he kind of phrased the question, who are you going to take? Atwater, has all these attributes. And not on speed, but, you know, how he plays and, you know, what do you think he can do for us? And anyway, and so some people say I picked him, which I did, but Dan Reeves was the guy that kind of set up the question. And so anyway, we picked Steve. And he beat out as a rookie in training camp. We had a guy named Mike Harden who was the safety there and had played there a long time and was a good player. But Steve was so good, we had to play him early. Before the last preseason game, we said, we'll go ahead and cut Harden because we want to give him a chance to go somewhere else. And we knew Atwater was going to play. We cut him the week before, and then that's when I went out to the field. Dennis Smith, who was our other safety, and was a great safety there, had played with Mike the whole time. They'd been roommates, I think, you know, in training camp and so forth. I said, Dennis, I said, what do you think about us cutting Mike? It was a Monday, you know, it was a Monday after we cut him. And he said, well, and I thought he was going to say, I'm upset that you cut him. He said, well, better him than me. Oh, I said, man, this is a hard world. I'm thinking, wow.
Yeah.
Now, Steve Atwater, YouTube it or whatever, I mean, the Okoye hit, I mean, is one of the all-time great hits in NFL football. So that Christian Okoye, the game he hit him and knocked him over backwards.
Yeah, at Mile High, I mean, that was when, I mean, Okoye was kind of this phenom, this big, strong back that was kind of running over everybody.
Oh, he's huge.
And
yeah,
he's there in Mile High with those fans, and, you know, I was sitting in the stands during that game, and that just gave you chills, just gave everybody chills, I think, all at once. Hit him a couple times in that game.
Yeah,
I'm glad you mentioned Dennis Smith too, just because that tandem of safeties back there, I mean, you talk about intimidating for other receiver skill players that are trying to go across the middle. I mean, both of those guys would really hit you, and of course Steve being, you know, he's legitimate 6'3" and change, and then, you know, with pads on, I mean, he looked like he was about 6'6" back there.
Well, Dennis was 6'3" also. I mean, right. Both of them were, and Dennis was a little heavier than. Now, Dennis was a really great player. He fit in our defense really well. We tried to utilize him in the running, you know, in the box, even more than Steve. He had one stretch that 9 games in a row he caused a turnover. Now, I don't know if I've been with any other player that's ever done that. Now, you know, some of them were fumbles, some of them were interceptions, but 9 games in a row, he caused a turnover. We went into Washington, and Elway was sick in the dressing room and didn't play, and he had one heck of a game in that game. He caused, I think, 2 turnovers in that game, but that was part of that stretch that he went through. He was really a special player, too.
He was great. I loved watching him. I remember being, as I got a little older, towards the very end of Dennis's career, but him, we were playing the Colts, and I was on the sideline. I think I was holding the cords when they used to have cords for the coach comm. I remember the back. It was Roosevelt Potts handed him the ball, and Dennis Smith came downhill and just knocked him out cold. I mean, you knew right away that, you know, Roosevelt was out, and just it really is a great if anyone ever gets the chance. I mean, obviously tough to get that chance, but to see the game live from the actual sidelines. I mean, just how fast these guys move and how hard they're striking each other, and but
it's control violence is what it is.
Yeah,
out there.
Yeah. I mean, I was still fairly young. I just remember my eyes shut. I mean, it was probably one of the reasons I never had any delusions of myself playing with those guys, you know, just yeah. I was able to be so close to it. And you see something like that, you say, okay, I don't want that to be me.
You know, Dennis, we had a rush where the Mike linebacker, who was Mecklenburg, Carl, who was a great player himself, Mecklenburg would rush, and then Dennis would fill in down in the box. But when it was a running play, I mean, people thought we were running safety blitz because he saw it, and he was in the backfield. I mean, he's right back there, right behind Mecklenburg, hitting the guy. So, I mean, yeah, I can't say enough great things about him, too.
Well, and Steve, if Steve ever hears this, just thanks for being so good to a little punk who was just hanging around. And he was one of the best guys, and just so good to me. Even when I see him now, I mean, of course, he was just elected last year to the Pro Football Hall of Fame, so it was great to see that for him. But just one of the great guys, you know, throughout your career, and I just have a lot of memories of him just being really good to me.
Yeah, he's that kind of guy. Yeah, he's one that everybody likes, and there's a reason for it.
Yeah, and then you were obviously a defensive coordinator and then head coach. A couple of other guys that were playing on that team at that time, of course, John Elway, and I believe you traded for Gary Zimmerman. Was that your first year as the head coach, or was that still with Coach Reeves?
No, when I took over, Bob Ferguson was the general manager, and he's the guy that found out that Minnesota was having trouble signing him, and they couldn't get him signed, and he didn't want to go back there. Money, I'm sure. And he suggested we needed for John Elway, we needed an offensive lineman, especially the backside protector, the left tackle. So he came to me and said, hey, this Zimmerman kid, you know, I think we can get him. So we went after him and we got him. And that's when I said, they asked me about him when we took him. They didn't know much about him. I talked about the press. And what I told them came out to be prophetic, I guess. They asked me, well, who is this guy? And, you know, why did you get him? And what's he going to do for you? And I said, well, next to Elway, he'll be the best player on the field. And sure enough, he was. So I pat myself on the back for that one, because I didn't know he was going to be, Fergie, he made a good pick there in trying to get him. And so we ended up with him, and he obviously had a great career, and it's a great player and a great person too.
Yeah, five-time first-team All-Pro.
Yeah.
Seven-time Pro Bowler.
Yeah, he went to Oregon. He's 6'6", 294 pounds, and just a really, really great athlete that you need at left tackle.
Well, and then, of course, John, I mean, when you got there, I mean, as the defensive coordinator, he'd already lost three Super Bowls. I mean, you all went to one your first year as defensive coordinator. First pick of the draft coming out, everyone knows, you know, he was drafted by the Colts and said he wasn't going to play there. Ends up with the Broncos, just, you know, a guy that I just idolized growing up. But, you know, what are your memories of John and just him as a player, as a leader?
Yeah, he was all of the things everybody thinks he was. I mean, you know, the guy was a phenomenal player, had tremendous arm. They can say whoever, but, you know, I don't know anybody had a better arm than him. Arm talent, too, I guess they call it nowadays, too. I mean, but he could throw it as hard as he wanted to. And if sometimes in practice, if a rookie dropped the ball or something, man, he fired the next one, and there's no way the guy could catch it. He'd go right through his arms. I mean, you know, he's first pick in the draft, number one. And at the time, everybody said he's the best quarterback to come out in 10 years. He lived up to that, too.
Right.
And interestingly, we had a little guy that played behind him that named Gary Kubiak, who was the backup quarterback.
That's right. And then later drafted Tommy Maddox.
yeah, well, we won't talk about that.
Well, one of the guys, I do remember when you were defensive coordinator still, and there was a guy playing on the, you know, the scout team, the look team, that was, I remember hearing from you that, you know, you guys were telling the offensive coaches, hey, this kid over here, this tight end, he said he's better than any guy that we're playing against.
His seventh round pick out of Savannah State. He was a wide receiver at Savannah State. Now he had a brother that played in the league for Green Bay before him. That was a pretty good wide receiver, but he's a little heavy at wide receiver. We had him playing wide receiver for a little while, but on the scout team, they had him playing tight end.
And of course, we're talking about Shannon Sharp here.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And so he's playing tight end on the scout team. And I did tell Dan Reeves that, and it is true. I said, Dan, we don't have anybody that we play against as good as this guy. Because if you know Shannon Sharp now, and if you know him then, it's, he's the same way. I mean, he'd catch the ball in practice and spike it on you and talk, yap at you and, you know, all that stuff. I mean, you know, he's a personality. You know him. I think everybody knows him from TV or whatever. But what a great guy. But, I mean, he's full of energy. You know, he'd run those routes and catch the ball and on Dennis Smith and Steve Atwater. I mean, you know, I mean, I told Dan, I said, we don't play anybody this good as this guy, you know. And they said, well, maybe we better look at him a little more, you know. They moved him from wide receiver to tight end, and the old rest of his history is history. I mean, the guy, he set the record when I was there for most catches in a playoff game. And everybody knows, I mean, what a great player he was.
Well, yeah, when I was, you know, working the training camps as a ball boy, and you always knew when Shannon was in the building, so to speak, because you heard him from somewhere. He'd come in singing the top of his lungs and just kind of brighten up the room. And not surprising that he's been very successful talking yeah, for yeah. a living. And
yeah, he can do that too for sure. But he was the first tight end to go over 10,000 yards. But we knew it pretty quick, at least, you know, our defensive guys, coaching on defense, Mike Nolan, Charlie Waters, and I, we couldn't cover him, really. So he's a special guy.
Yes, he is. All right, keeping in the we've talked about some great pass rushers that you've coached. I mean, we've mentioned, obviously, through the Oilers and Ricky Jackson, and, of course, the Eagles with Reggie White, and then Reggie White obviously retiring as the all-time leading NFL sacker, but then you had the opportunity moving to Buffalo to coach who ends up getting the record for 200 sacks, the all-time leading pass rusher sacker ever in the history of the NFL. He beat Reggie White's record, but you coached them both. What's your memory of Bruce Smith, and how would you compare those two guys, you know, the two guys that both retired as the leaders in that category?
Yeah, Bruce was, of course, he's out of Virginia Tech, and of course he was he was the number one pick in the draft. Everybody knew he was a good player. 6'4", Reggie was about 6'5", Bruce 6'4". Bruce was 275, you know, he wasn't a 300-pound guy like Reggie, but he had great speed. Obviously, Reggie had the most power of anybody I've been around with. Probably Bruce had the most speed and ability to get low. I mean, to come around the corner like he did, even his height, he could get so low coming around the corner that he just had a great flexibility, I guess you'd call it, too, besides the other skills. And he was already great when I got there. I mean, so Reggie was, too. I mean, Reggie was early in his career, certainly. He was amazing, the shape he was in. The great shape he was in. Like I say, he was 275, but I think when he came into the league, he was like 300.
Hmm.
He worked his way down and got into this whole team, the four Super Bowl team they had. they all excelled in having low body fat. That was one of their primary goals of their strength and conditioning guy.
Rusty Jones.
Yep, Rusty Jones got them to buy into it, basically. And they would compete each year to see who could come in the best shape and the best, lowest body fat. And, I mean, it was amazing. And I can see how it really helped those teams, and it helped a guy like Bruce Smith because he was in phenomenal shape. One year I was there, he was having an operation in the off season, and so he couldn't participate in training camp, basically. But he worked out, and he ran on the treadmill just unbelievably and was still in great shape. And so when we got the first game, now he hadn't played any games, any preseason games. He'd only been working out basically on his own. He went through individual drills, and that's about it. We played the first game against the Giants. I think we went 75 plays on defense. He played every play. And in overtime, we played an overtime game. In overtime, he sacked the quarterback, knocked the ball out. We recovered and kicked a field goal and beat him.
Hmm.
He went like 80-something plays. I mean, I was saying, well, you know, he's going into the game. We're going to have to rest him, watch the load we put on him or whatever. But he played every play, and he was phenomenal in that game. And from then on, I knew this guy's really special.
Does a guy like him, who'd obviously already been a great player before you got there, with like systems, was there concern from him or maybe players you've been with where you come in? And I know you've had some guys that you made into outside linebackers where you put them in a two-point stance, you know, when they've always been in a three, and there's some concern there. Or, you know, a guy like Bruce in base defense, I mean, he was playing the five technique, right?
Yeah.
Was there a concern from him about, you know, how he was going to be used? When you go into these things new, are guys kind of, these kind of established guys?
I think sometimes they were earlier in my career. Somehow my reputation, they thought I was a good coach and thought I was going to put him in the right shape or right position. I always preach that, you know, we're going to try to utilize your ability and, you know, give you the best chance to do as well as you can do. I'm not sure what Bruce thought when I got there, but, you know, he's still going to be a great player wherever you put him. But we did let him rush up the field, which he could do, or slant inside. That's what we did with Elvin Bethea. And then we played other guys that have the same position, played them differently because they weren't Elvin Bethea or Bruce Smith. But similar to what we did with Elvin, really, he was such a good, and you know, I mean, he was so good an athlete. I mean, sometimes he'd go over on offense and play tight end, and same thing. He's like Shannon Sharpe. You couldn't cover him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he could have been a tight end. He could run. He played ping pong. If you ever played, you played ping pong against him, I think. He was just a really high-end player that just was so agile and then had great confidence. Now, he was very confident in himself. You know, people say ego, but I think it's just confidence. The guys that know they can do things. In Buffalo, he would always be standing out in the cold weather with the short sleeves on and act like he'd been used to the cold weather all the time when the other team came by. And he'd stand by their dressing room when they came in too so they could see what he looked like, because he's a great-looking body.
Yeah, super long arms. And you mentioned, I think, before, this is a long time ago, but Bruce used to, the coaches' offices were kind of upstairs in the facility, and Bruce used to go up there and watch film on his own, but he didn't want anyone else to know that he was up there.
Yeah, Bruce, I don't know. I think he wanted everybody to think that he's just naturally better than everybody, which he was. But like, he'd get some sacks in the game and he'd say, well, I just ran by him and did this and that. But I knew that he went in and studied. You know, he studied the player he's going to play against, so he knew, you know, what techniques and what things he was going to try to use against the offensive tackle, and then he'd get two or three sacks, and after the game he'd say, oh, I'm just able to do that because I'm a good player, you know, which he was. He was both. He just didn't want to – he wanted people to think he didn't have to study to do it. He was just natural doing that.
Yeah, he was like doing extra. He had like a notebook on all the linemen that he had faced and what rushes.
Oh yeah, he worked against. He worked at it. He wanted to give that facade that Oh, he didn't have to do anything but just go out there and play because he was better than everybody, which he was. But he studied it too.
Just kind of wrapping up, if there is a theme, you know, of all the guys we've talked about so far, I mean, it's the extremely physically talented guys. A lot of times, because they've been so talented, a lot of times you find the guys that have such physical ability don't always play the hardest, don't always work the hardest, because it's probably been kind of easy for them throughout their lives. You know, they've been really good at whatever they do athletically. And then, you know, these Hall of Fame type guys, you know, they've just kind of got it all. Somehow they're really good physically, but also put in the work, whether it's Robert Brazil playing full speed every play of practice, or Bruce Smith getting extra film and keeping a notebook on all the pass rushers he's ever gone against.
Yeah, they have something that they want, even though they're great athletes, they want to be better all the time. They push themselves to be even better, and those end up the great ones.
Well, we will continue on in another episode, because there's a lot of great Hall of Famers still yet to come.
We've got a few left, yeah.